Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Great to be back behind the microphone. A packed program today with a diversity of subjects. First, we have a poll question today, and it's this. Is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Go to our WDEV Facebook page to cast your vote. Donald Trump thinks so, and I want to get your opinion on this. And if we get some time, we'll take a few phone calls on this subject. We'll talk about whether the press is out to get Donald Trump. Then Ann Galloway will join us to give us an update on the EB-5 programs. There's been some late developments on that. Wanted to keep you up to date on everything that goes on with EB-5. It's an important program for the Northeast Kingdom, or at least it's been shrouded in controversy, I guess, mystery and covered with a bit of controversy. And with the discovery, this is a very interesting story and caught my eye. I thought it was just interesting. Almost a 7-foot, 200-pound sturgeon in Isle of Mont washed ashore dead last week. And that got me to think, what is a sturgeon? Why is it important to protect them? And I found an expert. We'll check in with Chet McKenzie of the Vermont Fish and Wild Department. He's with the Fish and Wild Department's Lake Sturgeon Project. And we'll talk to him about lake sturgeon here in Vermont. And then Bob Ney will join us to talk about national politics. A lot going on in national politics. Donald Trump's foreign policy speech yesterday on ISIS and other things. Scranton, Pennsylvania, you had Vice President Biden and Hillary Clinton in town talking mostly about Donald Trump. We'll ask him about these events and also our poll question today on the press and Donald Trump. And Kenny Jenny from Integrative Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine will join us. We'll talk about cupping. You may remember last week we all had questions about cupping, and Carrie will be here to answer those questions. And finally, today is Bennington Battle Day. If you're trying to call a state office, you know that it's Bennington Battle Day. It is a state holiday, and state and local governments are closed. We'll speak with former Governor Jim Douglas about why we celebrate Bennington Battle Day. Plus, while I've got him on the phone, let's talk some questions about politics, especially the gubernatorial race, the gubernatorial primary, and the upcoming gubernatorial election. But first, the poll question. Is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Go to our WDEV Facebook page and cast your vote. Donald Trump thinks that they are. He tweeted over the weekend. He was pretty peeved at the press over the weekend. And what he tweeted was, if the disgusting and corrupt media covered me honestly and didn't put false meaning into the words I say, I would be beating Hillary Clinton by 20 percentage points. Well, is that true? So is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Go on our Facebook page and cast your vote or give me a call right now. I have a few minutes. Give me a call right now at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Is the press out to get Donald Trump the way that he tweeted over the weekend? What got Donald Trump peeved over the weekend are stories about a dysfunctional campaign. And there seems to be some truth in that effort as well. His family advisors are saying he really needs to deliver a consistent message making the case for change, that he needs to be disciplined. that he needs to focus on the growing economy, rising incomes, and fighting terrorism. And the election needs to be more about Hillary Clinton than about Donald Trump. So what do you think? Donald Trump says, if the disgusting corrupt media covered me honestly and didn't put false meaning into the words I say, I would be beating Hillary Clinton by 20%. He didn't say Clinton in his tweet. He said Hillary by 20%. What do you think? Do you think that the media is biased, is out to get Donald Trump? Two ways you can express your feeling on that is to go to our WDEV Facebook page, where we have the question, is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Or you can give me a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Ruth, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, I think the media is terrible, and I have called some of the stations. NBC won't take calls. I get the farmer's market. But, yes, I'm not a Trump supporter, but I think the news has been totally ridiculous and is insulting my intelligence. They make up these terrible scenarios about Trump, but when I see what he actually said and did, it's not what the media is saying at all. So I'm totally disgusted with the media. And unfortunately, I can't get cable TV, so I have to be stuck with free TV.
Well, thanks, Ruth, for your phone call. Appreciate your opinion. Is the media biased or showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? That's our question we're leading off with today. You also can go on to our WDEV Facebook page and cast your vote on your feeling. It's really interesting with Donald Trump. You know, Ruth brings up an issue, but is it all the press? I mean, Donald Trump, he's got to stop this tweeting. He's got to stop watching cable news, and he's got to sort of focus. I think his family and advisors are right. He's got to focus on the policy development and policy sort of explanations of where he stands on various things. What won him in the primary is not going to win in the general election. More people are focused in on the policy differences between he and Hillary Clinton. And if he – and no substitute. I don't care what it is. Twitter and social media and these rallies that he's holding are no substitute for a political ground game In a campaign. I mean, a political ground game is important. Getting voters out, getting voters energized, that's important. Social media, cable news, and rallies are not going to do that. And right now, he's losing relatively, he's losing badly. If you look at it, he's losing in every key battleground state. New Hampshire by double digits, the Midwest industrial states that he claimed that would be in play, like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, have now turned sharply against him and towards Mrs. Clinton. And he's fighting to stay relevant in Georgia and Arizona and even Utah. These are states that he shouldn't be fighting for in this election. And analysts say that this should be the year of the Republican, that it should be a Republican that is favored in this election. And yet, if you look at the polls, it's not even close. So the question is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Go to our Facebook page to cast your vote, or give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on open mic.
Yeah, first off, I mean, it's how dare the press report what somebody actually says in public? You know, I mean, how biased can you be when you report somebody's words? I'm saying that, of course, with a great deal of sarcasm. On the other hand, the press was definitely biased for Donald during the whole primaries when they would just basically let him say any outrageous thing he ever wanted to say and never bothered to try to fact check or find out really what it is that he meant in the whole time. So, you know, now the press is finally saying, well, you know what? You won the primary. You want to be president of the United States. This is what you said. This is how it came across. And this is obviously what you meant. So, you know, there's no bias there. It's just Donald being Donald. He's not running to be president of the United States. He's running to be Donald of the United States, and this is what you get.
Thanks, Rama, for your phone call. Let's go to Shelley. Is it Shelley in South
Carolina? It is. The press is unbelievably biased. If you look at the number of negative stories about Trump and the number of positive stories about Clinton, there is absolutely no comparison. She has been engaging in serious felonious activity. Her email server was not secure. I mean, look, Nancy Pelosi just got hacked, and Guccifer got all the phone numbers and email addresses of all the Democratic House and Senate members across the nation. If you think that there isn't a bunch of stuff waiting in the wings that's going to come popping out in October, I got news for you. What happens is the press doesn't want to present what's going on. They talk about dumb things like whether or not he kicks a baby out of a rally. We need to get down to brass tacks. Everybody's afraid to death of Donald Trump because he is not the status quo. He's not an Washington insider, and he doesn't take orders from the Republican Party, and he hasn't been bought by Wall Street like Hillary Clinton does. So he's sort of a wild card. People don't know how to deal with him. I think that he's using the new media very wisely, and he may say things that are controversial, but he does that in part in order to get attention. And getting attention is all about getting elected, because if the press doesn't mention you, then you're not going to be forefront in the news. You can't even read what they talk. I mean, they create these Clinton rallies and Photoshop them to look like there's more people than there really are. Thousands of people go to Trump rallies. Nobody wants to go see Hillary Clinton.
Thanks, Shelley. Thank you for your phone call. And we can continue this discussion. All you have to do is go on to the WDEV Facebook page and cast your vote. Is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? We've had pros and cons call in, and I appreciate your phone calls. I want to switch subjects now and welcome to the Open Mic program Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger. Good morning, Ann.
Good morning, Mike.
And there's been some developments in the EB-5 program that I just want to get our listeners up to speed. The receiver of Jay Peak Resort, Michael Goldberg, wants changes to the EB-5 program. Why?
That's because 700 immigrant investors are currently their immigration status is in jeopardy because of the alleged fraud at Jay Peak. And so he's hoping to lobby Congress for a change in statute that would exempt them from having to go through the usual process. You know, immigrant investors put up $500,000 each, and in exchange, the developer is supposed to create 10 jobs. And in two of the projects, Stateside, which is actually at Jay Peak, and ANC Bio, which is a biomedical center that was proposed in Newport, in those two cases, the projects either were not fully developed or were not constructed at all. And so Michael Goldberg is faced with the fact that the 10 jobs are not going to be created for each of the investors in those two projects. In addition, he says that 300 investors who already have permanent residency in the United States through EB-5 could be in trouble if USCIS, the Immigration Service, decides to take a hard look at the fraud at Jay Peak and could actually revoke their permanent green cards.
That's what I was having trouble sort of following in, is those 300 that already have their green cards. What would be the logic? Can you explain a little bit what would be the logic if they go back and look? Because the jobs were created, or at least they were alleged to be created to get their green card.
Well, I think it's hard to tell exactly because, you know, what's going on here, because I was not privy to the correspondence that Michael Goldberg is referring to in his interim report. And also, The Immigration Service isn't very good about talking to the press or anyone else. They're not very responsive. So I can only surmise from what I've read in Goldberg's report that they will be potentially taking a hard look at how the money was moved around in the early projects. You know, Tram House, which was the first project, was built with money from investors who thought they were helping to construct Hotel J. And the Tram House investor money was used to purchase Jay Peak Resort, according to the Securities and Exchange Commission. And so if USCIS determines that the money wasn't used properly, according to Goldberg, there's a possibility that they could revoke the permanent green cards for the 300 investors. How much of a reality that is anyone's guess, since USCIS won't talk to the press or even Michael Goldberg at this point.
So how is Michael Goldberg going to address this issue with Congress? You reported that he's hired an attorney. Are they going to be lobbying Congress on this issue?
Yes, they're going to be lobbying Congress. They've already tried to work with Patrick Leahy's staff, and I know they're in close contact with Leahy's staff, but even Senator Patrick Leahy has not been able to get a meeting with in the Immigration Service at this point. And so I think that Michael Goldberg's approach here is kind of a last-ditch one because the EB-5 program is going through a reauthorization process before the end of the federal fiscal year, which is September 30th. His feeling is that if he could change federal statutes regarding extraordinary circumstances like this one, that they'd have a chance of getting green cards for all of the investors. And as you know, we've reported and other news outlets have reported that many of the immigrant investors, first and foremost, they want their green card. They want to be able to live in this country and start their lives here. They want to be able to get jobs and start businesses. And with the kind of uncertainty they're facing, that's very difficult. You know, they can't tell an employer, I'm going to be here indefinitely. At this point, many of the investors have had to extend their temporary green cards for a year or 2 years. And they don't know after that exactly what's going to happen. Although I've talked to immigration attorneys who say that it would be very unusual for USCIS to deport people in the EB-5 program.
For the first time, the assets, how the assets of Ariel Quiroz's Miami office were seized was described by Goldberg's firm. Can you describe that sort of that day in April?
Yes, it was April 13th, and to the best of my knowledge, from the interim report Goldberg filed, he and his attorneys were on the fourth floor of 111 Northeast 1st Street in Miami, and they were removing computers and taking pictures of things and removing documents. And in the middle of that process, Ariel Quiroz arrived. And I'm not sure, you know, what kind of conversation they had at that point, but he was essentially asked to give up his corporate credit card, and he asked to be able to get access to certain documents and personal belongings, which he was able to get, and then he was asked to leave. And as far as I know, that office has been cordoned off ever since, and Ariel Quiroz shortly afterward had all of his assets frozen and was no longer welcome at the resorts in the Northeast Kingdom.
The resort has been in financial straits because of the fraud, obviously, and the lack of snow. How have they been able to keep going, pay their bills?
Well, they've had to defer payment. Mostly they owe about $5.1 million to vendors. That was new information. We knew that vendors were owed, but we didn't know how much, and that's a big number. Those vendors have been talked into staying on because Michael Goldberg pledged to them that he would pay them as they went along, and he does intend to pay the back debt, but that's going to take a while at this point because when the resort was shut down by the SEC temporarily, or when the asset was seized, the hotels, the resort is still open. Both resorts are open. But when the SEC stepped in, it was at the end of the winter season. It was the middle of April, and there was no money left. Typically, in a given year, a resort would have set aside some money from the winter season to get through the off season, which is from May through October. Now, this was a terrible winter. Profits were way down for Jay Peak Resort anyway. They reported a $1.8 million profit over the course of the winter, and that's much lower than the previous year. It was less than half. So it was a difficult year to begin with, but on top of that, because of the fraud, there wasn't any money in the accounts, and so Goldberg is faced with having come up with $6.5 million over the course of the six-month period to keep the resort going, on top of the $5.1 million owed to vendors, on top of $5 million owed to repair the tram. So he really started in the hole here, and he's had to borrow money from a reimbursement that was made by Raymond James to investors. He's had to borrow $1.5 million there. He's had to scrape up money from various bank accounts, and many of which were already depleted by Aero Kuros. So he's really struggling to keep the resort afloat, and at this point is looking to get a loan. And he hasn't disclosed how much that loan will be, but he's looking to get a loan to tide the resorts over through the rest of the off season.
Well, the final question, Ann Burke, is that open now?
Yes. Well, the hotel is going to be open the last two weekends of August, and the hotel, as you know, was finished at the end of December. But was never open because of a dispute between one of the contractors and the developers, and then because the SEC stepped in. The resort and the hotel will officially open on September 11th. Michael Goldberg felt that he couldn't keep both resorts open because, as I said previously, the off-season is expensive. So that's why he's delayed opening of Burke. But he's also said that that resort could sell more quickly than Jay. There's a simpler situation there with the hotel, and the price tag will be much lower than Jay Peak. So it's possible that he could find a buyer between now and next year.
And thank you for stepping in at the last minute to update us on the EB-5 program. I really think it's important for our listeners to keep abreast of this EB-5 program, and you're the person to talk to, so thank you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate it.
Ann Galloway of Vermont Digger. Up next, Chet McKenzie, Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's Lake Sturgeon Project Leader. We'll talk about sturgeon in Vermont lakes. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me this morning in our WDEV studios is Chet McKenzie, Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's Lake Sturgeon Project Leader. And I guess, Chet, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, one of the things I wanted to, you're going to have to get a little bit closer to the microphone. One of the things I wanted to ask, how did a Scot get involved with sturgeon in Vermont lakes?
Well, that's an interesting question. Growing up, I've always fished. I've been involved in the water. I was a diver at maybe 14 years old. So I've always been interested in fish. So my education was on the West Coast and then up in Maine. And I got lucky enough to end up here in Vermont managing and looking at fish populations here in the state of Vermont.
So let's turn to the sturgeon, because it's been in the news lately. There was this find in Islamont where there was, you know, nearly a 7 foot, nearly 200 pounds. It goes from 150 to 200, from 6 feet 9 inches to 7 feet. You know, it's a fish. So there's stories about how big this is. Next week it'll be 20 feet. But the question is, sturgeon. What's the origin of sturgeon?
Well, sturgeon have been, you know, around the world, around the earth for millions of years. You know, they were roaming the seas and fresh waters back when dinosaurs roamed. So sturgeon are an ancient fish. They're one of the few fish that, you know, has a cartilage. The skeleton is made of cartilage, not bone. They're covered with armored plates. They look old. You know, they're torpedo-shaped. They're gray. They have a pointed snout with barbels on them. They have a shark-like tail, and they reach very large sizes. Lake sturgeon here in Vermont, you know, a big one would be 200 pounds, 250 pounds, maybe 8 feet long. There's other sturgeon that reach 11, 12, 13 feet long, way up to 1,000 pounds.
Are they related to any other fish?
They are related to paddlefish, which is found in the Midwest. There's a few other ancient fish that the one I can think of immediately, though, is the paddlefish.
And in our lakes, what lakes are they in?
Lake sturgeon are only found in Lake Champlain, and they're found in no other lakes or ponds in New England except for the rivers that flow to the ocean. There are different species of sturgeon, short nose and Atlantic sturgeon, that, you know, enter these rivers from salt water for part of the year, and that's where they're found. But in terms of lake sturgeon, they're only found in Lake Champlain.
Are they found in other parts of the country, though?
Yeah, they're actually in Quebec in the St. Lawrence River. There's a large population where there's a commercial fishery. There's sport fisheries in the Midwest, Wisconsin, Minnesota. You know, those places have healthy sturgeon populations, and they still manage recreational fisheries on those.
And do we have a healthy sturgeon population here?
No, our sturgeon declined pretty rapidly. The commercial fishery declined rapidly in the 1950s. We listed them as endangered in 1972, closed the fishery in the late 60s. And when I was first here, you know, we rarely saw sturgeon when we were out working with other species. So when we started this project in 1999, we didn't even know if we'd find a lake sturgeon when we went out and looked at these historic spawning sites.
One of the things that is interesting on Isle of Man, at least, is that the sturgeon that came ashore, depending on who you talk to, is between 6 feet 9 inches and 7 feet. It weighs anywhere between 150 and 200 pounds. You talked about that they can get as big as 9 feet or 8 feet, I think you said. What's the average size of a sturgeon?
Well, we've been looking at sturgeon that are using the Lamoille and Winooski Rivers to spawn. And most of those fish are between 4 feet and 5 feet, and they weigh between 25 and 45 pounds. We've caught fish that weighed as much as 78 pounds that were close to 6 feet long. But most of our fish seem to be between that 4-foot and 5-foot size range.
One of the things that, when you see this animal, you wonder, is this the animal, a big sturgeon, is this the animal people are seeing when they see Champ?
I've always joked about that because I think the answer is clearly yes. If the first time I really got to see a lot of sturgeon was up on a tributary of the St. Lawrence, and I was up on a dam watching a spawning population, and the way a sturgeon comes out of the water and rolls its head up and then rolls its back forward and then rolls back into the water, and the last thing that comes out of the water is his shark-like tail that sticks up. So when you see that and have the illusion of water flowing by it, the fish looks like it's 10 or 11 feet long. The first fish that I was looking at, I looked at the person next to me and said, that looks like a 10-foot long sturgeon. And they have a bony, you know, spine, scutes on their back. And I could see somebody easily mistaking this fish for some, it is a prehistoric fish, and mistaking it for some other prehistoric animal.
We got some ugly-looking fish in our lakes. I mean, the sturgeon is not a pretty fish to look at.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Maybe
it is.
But there are other fish as well. But the sturgeon, if you catch a sturgeon, you must release it, right?
That's right. They're fully protected by the state. They're listed as endangered. You know, and I would hope that normally when they're caught, they're just hooked in their mouth, which is a protrusible mouth that they suction up food with. And so usually they can be unhooked really easily. So we'd like to know about it if people catch them, but we'd like them to be released immediately and, you know, try to handle that fish carefully.
One of the things I was curious about, you talked about commercial fishing with sturgeon. Are they edible, and what do they taste like?
They are edible. I can't say what they taste like. I've had it a couple of times out in the Midwest. And
it tastes like chicken, right?
Well, no. I won't even say that. It's a steaky type fish. That's all I'm not good at deciding what they taste like. But there are still commercial fisheries for them where they sell the flesh. And obviously caviar is harvested from them if they're caught at the right time of year. and there's a big demand for their flesh. So even back in the 1950s and 60s when we fished commercially here, I talked to one of the commercial anglers, and even back then he was getting 5 or 6 pounds for the flesh for lake sturgeon that were harvested from Lake Champlain.
Elsewhere in the world, do we see sturgeon?
Yeah, there's a lot of sturgeon populations. Many are in trouble because of their unique life history. There's a lot of populations in North America that are listed as endangered. Certainly there's beluga sturgeon in Russia where they harvest caviar. Some of those populations are in trouble. So there are sturgeon across the globe, and because of their unique life history, many of those populations are in trouble.
We're speaking with Chet McKenzie, who's with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. He is the project leader of the Lake Sturgeon Project. And if you wish to join our conversation, you have any question about sturgeon, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. I find this fish fascinating. So you're here, Chet, to answer some questions about sturgeon. And how long do they live?
Well, lake sturgeon can live up to 150 years. You know, we age some sturgeon that we caught back in the early 2000s, and the oldest one we aged was just around 50 years old. This fish that was found last week, we'll collect a spine from that fish today or tomorrow, and we'll age that. It'll be a while, sometime when field season slows down, but we'll age this fish also. And we do occasionally have sturgeon wash up. Last year we got another sturgeon by the bike path, and we collected spines from that, and we age these fish when we get the chance.
And being 150 years old, I would imagine there's not many predators for a sturgeon.
Certainly when they're small, they're covered with bony plates, and they're relatively sharp. I know that from experience. So they protect sturgeon once they reach about 5 or 6 inches from most other predators in the lake. The only predator that I know causes sturgeon mortality based on research in the Midwest is sea lamprey.
And what do they eat?
Well, sturgeon are bottom feeders. They have this protrusible mouth that opens up and they suck things up off the bottom. They have barbels on the front of their snout that they can sense things buried in the bottom. So they'll eat small fish, mussels, insects, worms. You know, they just kind of cruise that bottom area, that relatively shallow area of the lake, 30 feet and shallower, and they, you know, sense that food on the bottom, and then they protrude their mouth out and kind of suck the bottom up and filter out, you know, whatever food organism is in that mud that they're...
Do people that are fishing, do they usually catch sturgeon?
We lately have had a number of sturgeon caught in the spawning tributaries after these certain sections of the river open on June 1st. And normally people are fishing for bullhead or walleyes, and they do. I think the best year recently is, I think one year we had 12 sturgeon caught incidentally in the Winooski River. So people do hook into sturgeon occasionally.
And do they go up the river to spawn? Is that why they're in the river?
Yes. Every spring, a certain part of that adult population will migrate up into rivers to spawn.
We're speaking with Chet McKenzie, and if you wish to join our conversation, we're talking about lake sturgeon because it's fascinating talking about this subject. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, we'll speak more with Chet about lake sturgeon. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Chet McKenzie, and he is with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. He is the project leader for the Lake Sturgeon Project Program. And one of the things we're talking about is sturgeon. If you wish to join our conversation, if you have a question, a comment about the sturgeon in Lake Champlain, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Chet, when I was doing my research, I thought I saw that somebody caught a sturgeon in the Otter Creek. Am I mistaken about that, or is it just they stay just to Lake Champlain?
No, they caught it in Otter Creek, but that's one of the spawning tributaries. So that fish had come up out of Lake Champlain.
Just like the Winooski.
Just like the Winooski and Lamoille. This year was the first year we actually put an acoustic tag in a sturgeon in Otter Creek. We hadn't sampled there before, but I had asked anglers that I knew fish there and the Walleye Association if they could let me know if someone caught a sturgeon. So we were working on the Winooski this spring, and I got the phone call and heard there was a sturgeon caught there. So we rushed down the next day, and we were able to catch a sturgeon with our nets. And we don't know if that's the same fish. And then we ended up putting an acoustic tag on that fish so we could track where it goes in Lake Champlain.
Do you try to put an acoustic tag on every sturgeon you have?
No. This year we tagged an additional 11. Last year we tagged 10. I think we've caught about, in the last 2 years, 28 sturgeon in the Winooski, and I think the total is 31 sturgeon. We've only tagged about 19. We are trying to tag different populations so we can follow where they go out in the lake. We're looking for those areas of the lake where they congregate during the winter months, and last winter was the perfect opportunity because we were out on a boat on Lake Champlain in late December, early February, times we normally would not get out there and be able to track fish, and we're able to find these areas where they seem to congregate, which will make it our lives easier if we want to sample more fish.
Do they tend to stay in the same area, or do they migrate up and down the lake?
Well, you know, this is all brand new research that we started last year. We had no idea. And other big lake systems, they migrate a long way. Last year's fish, we tagged 10 in the Winooski, all stayed in about the same 9-mile stretch of the lake when they got out into the lake. This year, we've tagged a fish from the Lamoille, Otter Creek, and we've basically lost them. We tracked them for a while, and then they just kept going, so we don't know where those fish are on the lake yet. And we'll continue looking through the fall and hopefully find where they congregate.
We're speaking with Chet McKenzie, who's with the Department of Vermont Fish and Wildlife, and he is the project leader of the Lake Sturgeon Program. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Lynette in Greensboro, Bend. Good morning, Lynette. You're on open mic.
Thank you. I may be mistaken, but are there sturgeon and maybe pike on display at the Echo Museum, the Echo Aquarium?
There is, isn't there?
Yes, they do have had sturgeon. I believe they came from a Midwest source, one of the hatcheries out there, and northern pike are probably in their aquariums also.
Never go there without going down in the dark to go see them. They are fascinating.
Thanks, Lynette, for your phone call. So let's talk a little bit about the program that you're in charge of. You're the project leader of. Why does Vermont Fish and Wildlife want to know more about sturgeon?
Well, you know, lake sturgeon are really one of our few threatened or endangered fish species. They support a commercial fishery. They support popular recreational fisheries in other parts of North America. And we knew nothing about them when we started the project in 1998. So we really need to learn about their spawning migrations, the habitats they use. And we need to develop techniques that allow us to estimate their abundance in the lake. We've set recovery targets, we've set recovery goals, but without having the techniques available to measure them easily and count them, we need to work on that so we'll be able to see if we can reach those targets. Once we reach the recovery targets, 750 adults per river or 2,000 adults in the lake, we can delist them. We can move those from endangered to threatened and then maybe off the list completely and begin to develop another limited recreational fishery.
How do you go about doing that? How do you go about sort of knowing the population? You talked about tagging. Is that the way?
I certainly that's one of the tools. The tagging we're doing where we're actually actively tracking fish will lead us to areas in the lake where we can sample more fish because they do congregate together in the winter. And then we're also tagging these fish with another type of tag that is injected in under their skin and it never breaks out. It lasts for about 100 years. And we can also do some mark recapture experiments where we net the population multiple times, and you can look at the ratio of tagged to untagged fish and estimate a population. We'd rather not do that because you have to handle the fish, you have to net them. So this year we're beginning projects to use sonar, side scan, and did send to see if we can accurately count sturgeon as they migrate into the river to spawn or when they're out in the lake congregated in these overwintering areas. And that's, you know, cutting-edge work that's just being used across North America now, and I think it has real potential. We went out this spring, and we were able to use a research-grade side scan unit and see and identify lake sturgeon in the Winooski River. One researcher told me he felt that sturgeon had evolved just to be counted with side scan because they're such a unique fish. You know, they have that shark-like tail. They're 4, 5, 6 feet long. There's no other fish in Lake Champlain that you'll see that is that size, has a shark-like tail. You know, there's another, the dorsal fin's back towards the back. It has a pointed head. It really isn't an ugly fish. It is a beautiful fish and unique. So,
well, I guess it's in the eyes of the beholder here. One of the things that I'm curious about is when they do spawn, it would seem to me if they've been on in the endangered list since 1972, their population should be rebounding, yet it isn't. What is preventing that?
Well, we just finished a recovery plan, and we looked at those possibilities. And in my mind, what prevented the recovery was the sea lamprey predation on subadult sturgeon.
And, of course, sea lamprey does come down from the tributary. So,
well, the sea lamprey adults would be feeding on them in the lake, but because of a lake sturgeon's unique life history, they take 15 to 25 years to mature and spawn. They have very low natural mortality, like 4% or lower. So if you add any level of mortality on top of that, because it takes so long to spawn, they're so long-lived, the survival of their eggs is very low. You can drive populations to extinction with just a small amount of either fishing pressure or some additional mortality. So I think the big limitation is we have to reduce adult mortality by reducing sea lamprey, making sure the word gets out there protected so people don't poach them or accidentally kill them. And then the other big limiting factor is we've lost a lot of spawning habitat in Lake Champlain. You know, dams were built on these rivers sometimes back in the late 1800s, and they blocked the migration path to spawning habitat and possibly more importantly to nursery habitat. Usually a sturgeon will hatch out in the spring and spend the first 1 to 3 years in that river and nursery habitat before they migrate out into the lake and, you know, spend their adult lives in the lake except for when they return to spawn.
That's an interesting sort of aspect of their life. I didn't realize that they stay in that tributary during that time.
Yeah, they're unique. You know, they spend a long time. They live a long time. They spend a lot of time out in the lake. They migrate back in maybe only once every 2 years, or a female may only come back once every 5 years to spawn. They deposit their eggs over gravel and fast water. We've collected eggs before. Then when they hatch out, the young stay in that gravel for up to 10 days. And then at night, they emerge and drift downstream, and then they just settle out in slower areas of the river and stay there for a couple of years, feeding on, you know, insects drifting down in the bottom there. So pretty unique fish. We knew that there were adults there. We knew that eggs are being deposited. We also caught drifting larvae. So, you know, this stage we're in now is just to see if we can get a better estimate of the number of adults out there and see if their abundance is increasing.
What's your goal? What's your target here?
Well, we'd like to restore the population so they can be delisted and be a healthy population of lake sturgeon. We think that not only is that important because it could support a small recreational fishery, but it's an indicator of how healthy our lakes are, how Lake Champlain is, how clean the water is food available, are all the habitats available. So that's our goal, is to restore the population.
Is there a number, Chet, that you're looking for to restore?
Sure. We'd like to see either the spawning populations in each river be 750 mature adults. Now, only a portion of those would return every year, but that would be the population. Or on the lake-wide basis, we'd like to see a population of 2,000 mature adults. We're still not sure yet whether these populations in the different tributaries mixed together or not. Some of our recent tagging or acoustic tagging tracking suggests they do jump from one spawning river to another. So the lake-wide goal may be what we focus on, but right now we have both those goals in river numbers as well as the lake number.
What can the public do to help you?
Well, the public's been helpful just by letting us know when they catch a sturgeon, when they see a sturgeon. We wouldn't have tagged that fish this year in Otter Creek without an angler getting word to us that they were fishing that river. You know, people that find dead sturgeon report it. We get information from that. We get age structure from those fish. So the public can help by, you know, if they catch a sturgeon, release it, handle it well, let us know where and when you caught it. If they hear of other people catching sturgeon or if they hear of any illegal activity, you know, get involved. They've helped us in the past, I'd say, 10 years, and we're trying to get the word out so more people can be aware of the program and help out when they get the opportunity.
Now, this fish that washed ashore in Isle of Mont, what will you be looking for as you do get time to do the autopsy on that fish?
Well, I'd like to, you know, we'll measure the accurate length, both a fork length and a total length. We'll remove a spine so that we can age the fish, and there's a researcher at UVM who wants to see if they can also determine ages from those scutes, the armored plates on the side. So we'll collect some of those scutes so they can look at that. I don't even know if we'll be able to tell the sex. It sounds like the fish is pretty well decomposed, but if not, we'll be able to open it up and look at it, see what its sex is. So really, we're just after the basics. We will never be able to figure out why it died unless it was something obvious, but this wasn't. People have already sent me pictures. There's no, you know, obvious external wounds on the fish.
And if somebody wanted to find out more information about sturgeon or your program, how would they do that?
Well, the recovery plan is now up on the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department's website, and that summarizes the history of sturgeon, what we knew about them until the plan was written, the new acoustic tracking results or whatever. They could contact me, and some of that information can be shared.
And what else, Chet? Well, look, we've run out of time, and I could keep going and going on this sort of subject. I love this subject. So, Chet McKenzie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Chet McKenzie from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department. He is the Lake Sturgeon Project Leader at the department. It's a fascinating, the sturgeon is a fascinating, fascinating fish, and it isn't that ugly. Coming up, Bob Nave from Talk Media News, Carrie Jenny will talk about cupping, and Governor Jim Douglas will talk about Bennington Battle Day. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Coming up, we'll speak with Carrie Jenny about cupping. You've seen it at the Olympics. Let's find out what it's about. And former Governor Jim Douglas will join us and talk about why we're celebrating Bennington Battle Day. As many of you know, state office buildings and local government is closed today in Vermont in celebration of Bennington Battle Day. But first up, our good friend Bob Nave of Talk Media News is on the line. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Cupping is 3,000 years old.
Carrie is going to perform it on me, and I'll find out how it is. It looks.
Yeah, it's actually. I think it's good. Certain cases you can't use cupping if you're way too thin or obese. But I think and it helps to heal pain.
Well, we'll find
out.
I'm
not a cupping expert, but I travel the Eastern world.
And have you ever had it done, just out of curiosity?
Oh, my goodness, no. Are you kidding me?
Now you're making me skittish after Carrie said she's going to do it.
I have paraglided off the Himalayas, so anyway, so I can tell you cupping's okay.
Let's turn to politics. Over the weekend, Donald Trump tweeted this: if the disgusting and corrupt media covered me honestly and didn't put false meaning into the words I say, I would be beating Hillary Clinton by 20 percentage points. In our poll question today, for those listeners who want to go on to our WDEV Facebook page, is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? And Bob, I'm going to ask you that question. What do you think?
Oh, yes, they are out to get him. And yes, they're showing their bias. And yes, he's helping them. All right. I'm answering you honestly. Sure, they're biased. A lot of them are biased, but he is helping them. He's helping them. He's standing there with gasoline on the press bias fire.
And over the weekend, what he was upset about is over the weekend there were several stories, particularly in the New York Times. He was really peeved about the New York Times, about the dysfunction that's going on in his campaign. And his family and advisors are saying that he's got to stay on message, that he's got to be much more disciplined, that they want him to focus on the economy and raising incomes and fighting terrorism and put the focus on Hillary Clinton instead of himself. Is he capable of doing that?
Well, he can do it to some extent. He's not completely capable. Trump is going to be Trump, as Corey Lewandowski, his former campaign manager, used to say. But he could tone it down. He needs to let certain things get out there. I mean, the Clinton Foundation emails with two federal employees are honestly indefensible. To allow an employee to get on a train, federal government paid, on her own time, quote, and go get jobs for people that give gazillions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation is simply wrong, if not illegal, in fact. Now, having said that, Trump tends to step all over these messages. He really does. He just steps on the message. So, now, will the media pursue it? No, not as with full force. But if he doesn't give them, fuel for fire, then some of this will have to get covered more.
Recent polls shows that he is squandering a winnable race here, that he has a losing by double digits in New Hampshire, for example. The Midwest industrial states were supposed to be in play, like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. They've gone sharply towards Mrs. Clinton. And in states where he should be just blowing Clinton away, in Georgia, Arizona, and even Utah, it's a very close race. What does he need to do?
He needs to stop, the jokes, stop the off-the-cuff comments. He needs to get away from, if there's a court case on him, it's not all the judge's fault. He just needs to stay away from that whole deal, and he just needs to focus on issues. And he can hammer her directly. There's a lot of things he can hammer her on. And he just needs to continue to do that. I think there's going to be more emails out there. I really do, on the Clinton Foundation. I think there's going to be some really bad ones. But again, he needs to quit taking on people that don't support him. And a lot of Republicans have done damage to him. I understand that. And they're trying to now come around and support him. But he needs to not try to tackle the entire Republican Party. Just keep moving on. Keep with the issues and stay there.
Bob, you've been in politics a long time. There is a way of winning, and it's called the ground game, and it's a very, very important part of winning. He doesn't seem – you tell me. I mean, it doesn't seem from the outside that he has an established political ground game. He continues to rely on Twitter and social media and those rallies. Is that enough?
He doesn't have a ground game. I don't know that he can put together a ground game. If you look at the state of Ohio, Hillary Clinton in my home state, in Ella Ratner's home state, is so advanced on the ground game, it's not even close. He can't create a ground game that Hillary Clinton has here in Ohio. But he's dead tied in the polls with her, because no matter what ground game she's got, she is technically a weak candidate like he is. So I don't think he's got enough time to do the ground game. I really don't. So it's going to be about voter turnout. That's where he can utilize the Republican Party. And I would put every dime I have in, if I was Donald Trump, into the existing Republican structures for voter turnout. His ground game is too late. It's too late.
Let's turn to Hillary Clinton for for a minute. Bill Clinton went after the FBI the other day in his speech. Was that a warning shot to the FBI?
I don't know. He needs to. They need to keep him quiet too. Talk about Donald Trump. You know, he got on that plane, had no business getting on that plane. Anybody else, they would have indicted them over trying to do that. He needs to be quiet about the FBI. They've gotten breaks from the FBI, frankly, and I know they're angry because the director said the things he did. And by the way, they shouldn't be releasing the notes on Hillary Clinton. They really shouldn't, because she was not indicted. They don't do that. But they are, because this is high profile. But he needs to, he's sort of like Trump in a sense. He needs to back off of anything said about the FBI, anything. It's all too close quarters for him and the Obama administration and Hillary Clinton being Secretary of State. He needs to back off of any FBI criticism.
And as the internal sort of Trump people are worried about Donald Trump being Donald Trump, the Clinton people must be worried about, and you mentioned it, what's the next shoe to drop on these emails?
Look, the Clinton Foundation, and I know they're worried. By the way, and my suspicions, Mike, were justified. President Obama said something yesterday that's really, really important if we look at politics. And he said yesterday, don't take this for granted. I got a buddy of mine who's a Democratic consultant very close to Hillary Clinton, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he, all the time, he did it this week. Oh, Bob, the Trump clown car. And I said, keep going. Keep going with it, because President Obama knows, don't let your guard down. Who knows what shoe's going to drop when it comes to Hillary Clinton and Bill? I mean, really, who knows what shoe's going to drop? And I'm not trying to be, you know, I'm not shilling for Donald Trump. I'm just, if I was in the Clinton campaign, I would be sitting there saying, we got to do it better, we've got to do it smarter, because we just don't know what's around the corner. And you don't know. Look at the last two emails. A whole other batch is going to drop. Plus, what does WikiLeaks have that they're going to throw out there? And somebody could say, well, it's not the end of the world. It's not, but it could make a tight race.
Bob Ney, as always, great insight. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you so much.
Bob Ney, Talk Media News. Coming up, Kerry Jenny, and we'll be talking about cupping, which is, I just find fascinating. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in the studio, our WDEV studio, Kerry Jenny. She's a licensed acupuncturist. She's with Integrative Acupuncture, and we're going to talk about the subject of cupping, which Kerry and I talked a little bit before we went on air here, and she wants to demonstrate cupping. I'm a little apprehensive about this, but good morning, Kerry.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So before we get into this, mm-hmm. and whatever you're going to do to me, can we talk about, we've seen the Olympics, and certain competitors have these circles on their bodies that look like hickeys, but it's called cupping. What is cupping?
So cupping has been around for thousands of years. I know about it because it's part of traditional Chinese medicine. And what it's doing is increasing circulation to areas of overused muscles. So the swimmers, like Michael Phelps, are very smart to be using cupping on their arms, which certainly they must be overusing the muscles. What the cup is going to do is it's going to pull up on the muscle. You can think of it as almost the opposite of a massage, where a massage pushes down on the muscle. The cups are going to pull up on it, and it's going to create circulation underneath the cup when a vacuum is created. The other thing that's going to happen is it's going to kind of tell the body to heal this area. So if there's any micro traumas, if there's any small tears in the muscle, it's going to realign the muscle fibers and cause healing to happen underneath the cups.
So it is sort of like a big hickey.
It's not too different from a big hickey. And I'm glad you know that, because some people think it's like a bruise. But it's very different than a bruise. A bruise happens because of trauma. There's an injury there. And a bruise also hurts to touch. But the marks that are potentially left from the cups do not hurt to touch.
I don't believe you.
You're going to find out.
So how does this happen? I mean, you've got several cups here.
I have a lot of different types of cups, and they're all rather modern, because traditionally, thousands of years ago, cupping was done using animal horns. And then they realized that they could use pottery, so they started making cups out of pottery. And then they realized they could make it out of glass. So fast forward a bunch of years, and here we are with Michael Phelps in the Olympics, and they're using silicone and plastic cups.
And what do you do? How does this, before you do this to me, I'll sign right here. What is involved?
Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'd like to demonstrate using the vacuum cup, which is what Michael Phelps is doing. So we want to see you out in the pool right after demonstrating your Phelps swimming after I do this to you. I'm going to use a plastic cup that has a pump on it, and I'm going to create a vacuum and adhere it really quickly to your arm.
Well, let's do this.
Okay, let's do it.
Right now.
Yeah.
And is this becoming more and more popular?
It is becoming more and more popular. 4 years ago, there was cupping marks all over swimmers, and we had a little bit more interest in the acupuncture community of people asking about cupping. But this year, it's really just gone big time with Michael Phelps showing up with these cupping marks and winning all these gold medals. And it's made national news, so a lot of people are calling and asking about it.
So what I'll do as you're getting ready is I'll try to describe what you're doing.
Okay.
So let's go. You're grabbing a cup right now, and what is the other device that you have here?
So this is a suction pump. It's just going to pull the air out as I quickly adhere it to your arm.
Okay.
You're going to want to use a muscular part, so I'll use the forearm here.
Okay. You're not going to kill me here, are you?
Didn't you read the consent?
And as you pump it up, it actually brings the skin up, like a little mound on it.
Right, underneath the cup, yep. Now, depending on if you actually need this technique is if you're going to see those marks. So those circles are actually formed when there's overused muscles or areas where there needs to be an increase of circulation in blood. So if I do this to someone who doesn't need it, there might not be any of those markings left. So the technique is actually diagnostic as well as being therapeutic. So it tells me where the areas are of injury based on where those marks are left.
And so if we leave this now, there may not be a mark, is what you're saying.
There may not be, yeah.
And I won't have to go home and explain what this mark is.
Well, we do it a lot to kids, actually, and we call it the octopus treatment because it leaves these little circles. Yeah. So for kids, cupping is used for all sorts of things besides musculoskeletal issues. I use it a lot for respiratory issues for kids, from croup to bronchitis to asthma, cough, and I'll do it on their chest and their upper back. My kids love it.
And when... what it feels like is like there's pressure, like it's being pulled at, and it has a mound here on my arm with a sort of a plastic cup over it, and the suction is brought out. And
does it hurt?
It here's how it feels. It feels a little tight. Mm-hmm. That's what it feels like. It doesn't hurt. I mean, you're not in pain, but it's a little tight.
Mm-hmm.
And is that the normal?
Yeah, the arm isn't the most common place to cup. More often, I'm doing it to people's backs, and I'm using more than one cup at the same time.
That would feel better on the back, I think.
And I'm applying oil to the back first, so I can do a technique called running cupping, where I move the cups up and down, and it really just feels like a great massage.
How would we undo that now?
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay, there's going to be a cool noise, too.
Okay.
A little pop.
Whoa. Oh, I'm going to have to explain that.
Nope.
It will go away?
That'll go away within minutes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, if Michael Phelps-style cupping marks would last for 3 to 4 days, maybe even up to a week if someone really needs it.
And how long would, like, a normal procedure, because we were only doing this for a few minutes, how long would a normal procedure be?
I usually use cupping when indicated as part of a complete treatment plan. So I practice all of the branches of traditional Chinese medicine, which includes acupuncture, herbalism, nutrition, massage therapy, and exercise. So if somebody comes in with back pain, I'll make a diagnosis and determine what the best way to treat that back pain is. And if it is cupping, of their 1 hour treatment, we'll do cupping for maybe 10 or 15 minutes of it. And then I'll integrate a little bit of massage and some acupuncture. At the end, I might teach them some exercises or movements to help with their back.
And it's muscular that you're looking at, not structural, not bones.
Yeah, this particular technique of cupping is the muscular. So that's why it takes, a professional to make the diagnosis of if you need the cupping. It's not something we should be doing ourselves or at home. Because if it's nerve pain, we'd rather use something like acupuncture.
And You piqued my interest with respiratory. How does this help with respiratory issues?
Yeah, so, you know, when you get a lot of junk in your chest, and if you hit on your chest a little bit, it'll help you cough it up. So that's what the cupping is going to do. It's going to help create movement to your lungs, a little bit of mild contractions to your lungs to help you cough up the junk. That's really good for kids who sometimes can't get it up themselves.
And why has it become so popular with athletes, especially swimmers? Is it the muscular aspect of the arms and the back?
I'd say also because it's 100% natural and there's no side effects.
And that can cause you problems in the Olympics if you take something.
Absolutely. And also the side effects, they don't want to have downtime after a procedure that's going to help them.
Is it better for a certain type of athlete?
No, it can be used for anyone with muscular pain, so it does not need to be a professional athlete at all. I treat people who do running or any kind of athletics, from climbing to sports of any kind, with cupping.
When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about integrative healthcare and what that means. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Carrie Jenny, licensed acupuncturist, and with the firm Integrative Acupuncture. And we have been talking about cupping. We're going to talk about acupuncture in a minute. I'm looking at some scary needles. But I will, before we do that, Carrie, what I was wondering is, you showed me one technique of cupping, and it was sort of this plastic cup, and you used a suction to take the suction out.
Yes.
But I've seen online, when I was trying to do some research here, glass and using some sort of flame. How does that work?
So that's the traditional fire cupping, and it's my preferred method of doing cupping. One of the reasons is because it applies just a little bit of heat. So any kind of muscle pain that feels good in a hot shower or putting a hot water bottle on is going to feel really good to get this heated fire cup. And so what I do is I take a cotton ball and I put a little alcohol on it, and just quickly put it into the glass jar and adhere it to a muscular area. And it's also going to create a vacuum and pull up on the muscle.
And that has the same effect as what we just did, but it's got the warmth as well.
It's got the warmth. I also like it because I have a little more control of the amount of pressure, and I can also move it. So I can do this technique called running cupping, where I move it up and down your back, and it just feels like a great massage.
If you have any questions about cupping, give us a call. The number is 802-244-1777, or toll-free at 877-291-8255. It's been my first experience with cupping. It's interesting, to say the least. Let's talk about integrative healthcare. What does that mean?
Integrative healthcare is hopefully the future of our healthcare. It's about a bunch of different providers with different expertise working together and communicating for your best health. So our practice, Integrative Acupuncture, has been working collaboratively with the Montpelier Health Center, now called Integrative Family Medicine Montpelier, which is part of University of Vermont Medical Center, Central Vermont Medical Center's downtown Montpelier location. And we have medical doctors and nurses and physical therapists, and then we've got the acupuncture piece and massage therapy. And we all get together and learn from each other, and we send referrals to each other. And we're just trying to provide the best care possible for each patient, customized and individualized for them.
And do you see a growing awareness of different types of medicine?
Absolutely. People are coming to us with conditions that they've already had treated with a number of different therapies. And instead of just ignoring what they've done in the past, now we're communicating with each other and finding out, what did you do that worked? What can I do that can help this person even more?
You got scary needles sitting in front of
me
here.
You think so? They're about the size of a human hair, Mike.
What are they used for?
So these are acupuncture needles. They're stainless steel. They're very small. They're about the size of a couple of hairs. And we use acupuncture needles on the body when indicated for all sorts of conditions. But we're most well known for pain management.
How does it work?
I'm glad you asked. Acupuncture has been explained for thousands of years as having to do with reestablishing harmony and balance to the body's energy. Maybe you've heard of the word qi, like Tai Chi. So this has been the idea that we have more than just bones and muscles in our body, but an energetic system. And these needles establish harmony once the energetic system gets out of balance. But I want to translate that for you into modern medical terminology. So what we're realizing is that when the acupuncture needle goes into the body's going to respond as if it would to any foreign object, and that is push it out. And the way it's going to do that is by relaxing muscles and increasing flow of blood around the acupuncture needle insertion. And that's really good for pain management, to have muscles relaxed and fresh blood flow. The other thing that happens is your brain is going to process the acupuncture as an injury, and it's going to do all the things it would do for a normal injury to your body. So it's going to flood your body with endorphins, dopamine, and serotonin. And maybe you've heard of some of these happy chemicals that naturally occur in your brain. Well, when your body gets flooded with these, you have pain reduction and relaxation. A lot of people fall asleep during acupuncture.
Does it hurt?
How about we do a demonstration? You tell us.
Okay, let's try this.
Let's do it.
Why do I put myself in this?
So we're going to do it on your forearm here.
Okay. There's bone there, so watch it.
Luckily, acupuncturists have 3.5 years of training and master's of science degrees.
I was just
very well aware of where your bones are.
Before we do this, can you just explain? I was going to ask that question. What sort of training do you have to go through?
Yeah, it's a lot. So it's a postgraduate training. First, you get a bachelor's degree in like a pre-med kind of study. And then you do 3.5 years of postgraduate master's of science degree level training in acupuncture and herbalism and all those massage therapy, natural medicines. And then you're licensed with the state. And just like every other healthcare professional, you maintain your license with continuing education units.
Okay.
All right.
Go ahead and try this.
All right. So just relax your arm. All right. We'll do it on three.
Yep.
One. Two. Oh, already done.
I didn't feel that. That's amazing.
Pretty cool, huh?
That is pretty cool. And how many of these would you put into a person during a session?
It really varies. I use about 10 needles, but I treat so many different conditions and so many different people that it varies a lot. Like I treat children and they might only have one needle. And then I might treat a strong, muscular person and they might have more like 15.
And what would be sort of the treatment that people would come in for?
People come in for everything. Acupuncture and really all of traditional Chinese medicine is considered a primary care medical modality. So a lot of people, particularly in other states where acupuncturists are primary care providers, people choose acupuncture as their first line of defense. So they come to us when they have a cold. They come to us for gastrointestinal, tummy stuff, treat a lot of headaches and migraine issues. One of my specialty areas is obstetrics and gynecology. So I help women achieve pregnancy that are having a hard time getting pregnant or staying pregnant, and lots of complications that go on in the pregnancies.
We're speaking with Carrie Jenny. She's a licensed acupuncturist with Integrative Acupuncture, and there's a longer name to that. It's Integrative Acupuncture and Oriental Medicine.
Got it.
I don't have it on my sheet, but I remember seeing that. One of the things, let's stay with acupuncture for a moment. Is it both structural and muscular?
Yes, acupuncture is going to treat the whole system. So we treat the nervous system, we treat the circulatory system, musculatory system.
And does insurance cover this?
Oh, what a great question. I'm glad you asked. Some insurance companies are covering acupuncture. We are very busy in the Vermont Acupuncture Association to try to achieve insurance coverage for all Vermonters. Last legislative session, we were able to get acupuncture included into the opiate bill. So currently they're studying the use of acupuncture for pain management because we're trying to get acupuncture to be an alternative for prescribing opiates for pain. So if people have the pain and they want to try something else, they can at least try acupuncture. And right now, a lot of people have a barrier to accessing the care because it's an out-of-pocket expense.
One of the things in my earlier years, because of what I did, there's a lot of injury in the joints. Mm-hmm. Now, does acupuncture help those injuries?
Yes, we treat a lot of joint pains, arthritis, all sorts of joint pains. And again, acupuncture is just one part of the whole picture of our toolbox. So we might use topical herbal salves. We might do internal herbs. We might do the massage therapy or the cupping. It really just depends on the condition the person is showing. But we have lots of results with arthritis and joint pains.
We're speaking with Carrie Jenny, licensed acupuncturist. We've been talking about cupping. We've been talking about acupuncture. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I want to turn to nutrition. Is nutrition an important part of integrated healthcare?
Absolutely. So nutrition is one of the five branches of traditional Chinese medicine. We most often encourage people to talk to us about their nutrition, and it's part of our intake on the first time seeing somebody is asking about their nutrition. Now, Chinese medicine looks at food a little differently than other dietary suggestions might. For example, we look a lot at the nature of food. So think about the type of food we're eating right now in summertime, watermelon and cucumber and radishes. Those are considered cooling foods, so it makes sense that we would eat it in the summertime. Whereas conversely, in the wintertime, we might eat stews or foods that have been cooked a long time, sprinkle some cinnamon in our oatmeal. Those are warming foods that make us feel warm. So in Chinese medicine, what we do is look at a condition, like if a person is, example, look, trying to lose weight. And we might see that they're a cold person. They get cold hands and feet. They're easily tired. They're maybe even cold to the touch. So we would recommend this person eat warming foods to lose weight. So we'd be recommending eliminating the traditional salads, which people think about as being weight loss foods, and eating cold, uncooked foods, and rather recommending cooked foods.
So where do Big Macs and potato salad fall in there?
They're not even on the list. Moderation.
Do people come to you for weight loss?
Yeah, we treat people for weight loss. I really see it as part of a holistic treatment. I tell people up front if they're looking for a magic bullet, we don't have that. But if they're looking for something to integrate with their dietary changes and their exercise, acupuncture and Chinese medicine can absolutely be helpful to reducing sugars and carbohydrates, regulating the digestive system, because we need to have a regular digestive system if we're going to have sustained long-term weight loss, and also working with any chronic pains that might be preventing them from exercising.
One of the things that I've always wondered, can you use acupuncture to stop appetite?
Only if you put it right through the lips, Mike. Just kidding. Acupuncture for reduction of appetite has been shown to be helpful in the ears. So we do some acupuncture in the ears on Thursday evenings. We do a $10 walk-in clinic at our office, and people can try out acupuncture, and we can do it in the ears for reduction of appetite. It's really helpful for sugar and carbohydrate craving reduction.
When we talk about this integrated healthcare, herbs are part of it, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Herbs.
And how?
So herbs are plants and roots and barks and minerals and berries that are used as medicine. In Chinese medicine, we use formulas. So just like a balanced diet wouldn't just be eating kale all the time, Chinese herbalism is
Thank
not
God.
Just Chinese herbalism is not just about take echinacea for a cold and flu. Rather, it's about creating a formula of 10 or 15 different herbs that all work to create together to create balance for a condition.
One of the things, how do people find out about this, and how do they sort of get up to speed on this? Because this is an evolving sort of medical alternative, isn't it?
Absolutely. A lot of people are coming to us from their doctor's referrals, particularly in our office where we work so closely with the medical doctors on the first floor. They're coming in to see their docs, and they're recommending that they try the acupuncture, and they sometimes come right up to us right after their doctor's appointment and schedule their first visit. Other people are coming to us because word of mouth. A lot of the state employees have, they all have insurance coverage, so it makes it more accessible for them to give it a try. And I find that I treat a lot of people in the same offices because they come back nice and relaxed and maybe with their condition a little bit relieved after a treatment, and they tell their coworkers.
Is this a one-time treatment or is it a repetitive treatment? For example, acupuncture or cupping. Is it a repetitive treatment?
In general, it's a repetitive treatment. So it depends what a person is coming in for. If you have an acute condition, say you sprained your ankle over the weekend, I'm going to want to see you a few times this week and maybe next week until it's resolved. But then just like you keep your oil changed in your car, acupuncture is preventative medicine. With each insertion of an acupuncture needle, your body has an immune response and it increases the production of white blood cells. So it's really great for your immune system to have acupuncture a few times a year, just as preventative medicine.
And what's the most common question you get?
Does it hurt?
And it doesn't. I can testify to that. It doesn't. Good. Again, where can people find more information about this?
So our practice is in downtown Montpelier. We're at acupunctureinvermont.com. And to find an acupuncturist in other parts of the state, you can check out the Vermont Acupuncture Association website at vtaa.org.
Carrie Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Carrie Jenny, licensed acupuncturist and with Integrative Acupuncture. And before I turn it over to Artie, I want to just take a moment and talk about Jet Service Envelopes and Barry. And the reason I want to talk about them, because for generations, the Blow family has been meeting the printing needs of their customers. And their focus is where it needs to be, right on service. If you want a printer who combines quality, personalized, friendly service, and job dependability, guess where you got to go? That's Jet Service Envelopes in Barrie. The employees there, well, they take great pride in their work, and that pride is reflected in the quality products they produce for you. If you need printing services, whether envelopes, posters, cards, newsletters, brochures, or a magazine or book, Jet Service Envelopes and their sister organizations, Accurate Printing and Spalding Press in Bethel, can meet your needs. Just visit Jet Service Envelopes. Just off exit 6 on I-89 in Barrie and Spalding Press on Main Street in Bethel during the working hours, 7 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., or email them at info@jetservice-envelope.com. Coming up, former Governor Jim Douglas. We're going to be talking about Bennington Battle Day. Why do we celebrate it? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic former Governor Jim Douglas. Good morning, Governor Douglas.
Good morning, Mike. How are you cupped?
I am cupped and punctured here with acupuncture. So it's been an interesting day. Hey,
for where?
Governor, why do we celebrate Bennington Battle Day?
Well, the Battle of Bennington was fought on this day in 1777. It was a key battle in the American Revolution. I always said when I was in office that we would be singing God Save the Queen, but for the Battle of Bennington, that may be a slight exaggeration. But it was important militarily because it slowed General Burgoyne's advance to Saratoga, which was a key engagement a little later. His army lost 1,000 men at the Battle of Bennington, and so it really reduced his effectiveness when he went on to that more famous battle at Saratoga. As I'm sure you know, Mike, it wasn't actually fought in Bennington.
That was going to be my question. Why doesn't New York celebrate Bennington Battle?
Well, I don't know if they celebrate it, but there is a historic site over in Hoosick, just across the state line. The reason it's so important and celebrated as the Battle of Bennington is that Bennington was their objective. Burgoyne forces, mostly under Hessian leadership, actually a colonel named Friedrich Baum, who was killed at the battle, was leading his troops to get supplies, horses, other animals that were being kept at Bennington. And so it's because of his efforts there and the fact that he was repelled by General John Stark of the New Hampshire Militia and Colonel Seth Warner of the Green Mountain Boys that that we celebrated as an important engagement. It was in 1777, as I mentioned, but it took more than a century before the monument was built. But we had presidential visitors in the 19th century, Mike. In 1877, on the centennial, President Rutherford Hayes came to the site and led a parade up Monument Avenue and a big celebration at the site of what's now the monument. And then in 1891, President Benjamin Harrison came for the dedication of the monument. We had a celebration in 1991, the centennial of the construction of the monument. We didn't get a presidential visit, though, that year. We had speeches by people like me.
Governor, was it more of a state holiday at one time?
Well, it's still quite a celebration in Bennington. I assume that the parade was Sunday. That's been traditionally the date I always attended when I was in office. A big parade, arguably the largest in the state. It literally goes for hours through the downtown area there. And there are all kinds of other events and commemorations as well. It's a state holiday, as I'm sure our listeners know. We always used to get phone calls, you'll remember, on the 17th of August asking, was there something wrong with your phones yesterday? Why didn't anybody answer? Well, because obviously state offices are closed, and I think municipalities go along with it as well. I'm guessing, Mike, through the passage of time, that the attention that it gets, especially statewide, has declined. But it affects everyone because it's a holiday and invites conversations like this.
Has there ever been discussion about eliminating it as a state holiday? So that's because we find that most other organizations are working today, whether it's banks or other, you know, stores, those sort of things. Has there ever been any discussion about eliminating it as a state holiday?
Well, there's been discussion over time about the total number of state holidays and trimming it to be a little closer to what most private sector employers offer, and that has happened to some degree. We used to have both Lincoln's birthday and Washington's birthday as state holidays in February, now they're combined into the generic President's Day. I'm sure everyone thinks profoundly about Zachary Taylor and Millard Fillmore on that day in February. But it's the kind of discussion that state administrations and the state employees union have from time to time, and that change was made some decades ago. I think Columbus Day is now what's called a floating holiday, where state employees are allowed to take it off or not at their discretion. But Bennington Battle Day generally didn't come into that discussion, I'm guessing because it's summertime and all the state workers thought it was a pretty nice opportunity to have a day off.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. Governor Douglas, now that I've got you here, I want to talk a little bit about politics. We're talking...
What? Bait and switch?
It is a bait and switch on this one. We're talking about Bennington Battle Day, and if you wish to join our conversation about that, you can give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. But just somewhat on the primaries, what is your take on money in politics nowadays? $5 million, over $5 million for a gubernatorial primary, most expensive ever. Is this the new norm?
I worry that it is. It's very disappointing. Vermont has not made that huge a leap, although the cost of political campaigns has increased. In 1976, Dick Snelling and Stella Hackel, his Democratic opponent, established a spending cap of $80,000, if I recall correctly. So we've certainly come a long way. But this seems like an extraordinary jump. Obviously, Bruce Lisman spent a lot of his own resources in the primary, but even on the other side, there was at least $1 million race, if I understand correctly. So maybe we're just like other places. We like to think of Vermont as unique and special and a state where retail politics matter. Maybe not. Now, of course, I'll give you a counterpoint, Mike. Scott Milne didn't spend a whole lot and darn near won the governorship 2 years ago. So maybe if circumstances are favorable to that kind of effort, it can still be done, but that seems unlikely.
It seems like if there's an open seat for governor, you're going to have to spend $1 million in a primary if it's contested in a primary, because if you look, they were all either over $1 million or just under $1 million, but each candidate had to spend nearly $1 million, which is sort of unheard of.
Very disappointing. My runs, including primary and general, though I never had a contested primary, were in the million-ish range for the entire enterprise, and obviously we're going to see more than that spent by the two nominees.
What does the primary teach us? Do negative ads work?
Oh, I think they do to some degree. They raise doubts in the minds of some voters. I certainly ran into people around the state who volunteered that they didn't realize that Phil Scott was so close to Shumlin, and I was kind of taken aback. So obviously there was some impact from those who don't pay as close attention as you and I and some others do to the state political scene. So yeah, I think they do. That's why candidates use them.
Does the money raise turnout? Does it have an effect on turnout?
I suppose there's some incremental effect if it's particularly if it's spent on getting out the vote efforts, which it was in some cases. We certainly got a lot of calls and mailers from candidates reminding us, but it may be hard to assess this year because the primary was moved earlier for the first time. That's another point, Mike. I think summer primaries are problematic. People are thinking about vacationing and spending time with their families and not about politics. So I'm not sure it's a good idea to have it when we do, but here we are. Still pretty low event, and that's why probably candidates spend even more, because they want to turn out their troops.
And what will be some of the issues, you think, in this upcoming election?
Well, it's generally all about the economy, and I'm sure it will be, even though, as we are used to hearing, the unemployment rate is low. But most people don't feel like the recession is over in Vermont. The workforce is shrinking. People are leaving the state on a net basis. We've got to rebuild the workforce and make it affordable to live here so that we can have a robust economy. But I think there's another key issue this year that's not as traditional, and that's trust in government. Whether you're a single-payer healthcare scheme fan or you just think government ought to work well and are following the travails of the health exchange, a lot of people aren't as enamored of state government and those who have served into this. Perhaps they were in the golden era where you and I served. So I think that's going to be an issue, restoring trust, and we'll hear a lot about that in the next few months.
Governor, let's go back to Bennington Battle Day for a minute and sort of lead us through how Hubbardton and Bennington Battle Day sort of fit in with each other.
Well, the Battle of Hubbardton was actually the only battle fought on Vermont soil. That was a month or so before Bennington. It was in early July of 1777. That was when there was an engagement in the Rutland County town of Hubbardton. It wasn't as extensive, perhaps, as Bennington in terms of the number of forces engaged, certainly the number of casualties, but it was part of the effort of picking away at the British forces. Hubbardton was technically a loss for the Americans, but any kind of engagement weakens the other side. So it was part of a string, as I mentioned. Then in the fall of 77, Saratoga occurred. That was a major American victory over General Burgoyne and his British forces. So I think it was all part of the narrative. But you know how state holidays happen, Mike. Probably the Bennington legislative delegation was particularly active at some point, persuaded their colleagues to to do that. An early July holiday tied to the 4th for the Battle of Hubbardton wouldn't have been a bad deal either.
Governor, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you coming on a state holiday.
Well, it doesn't much matter to you and me anymore, does it?
No, it doesn't. Governor Douglas, thank you.
Happy Battle Day, Mike.
Thank you, Governor. That's former Governor Jim Douglas. Really appreciate him taking the time to sort of lead us through why we celebrate Bennington Battle Day. And, of course, all state offices, most local offices are closed today in celebration of Bennington Battle Day. I want to thank our guest, Ann Galloway from Vermont Digger, talking about the EB5 update. Chet McKenzie from the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department talking about the Lake Sturgeon Project. Bob Nay from Talk Media News. And Carrie Jenny, a licensed acupuncturist from Integrative Acupuncture, talking about cupping and acupuncture. And, of course, our poll question today, if you want to go on to our WDEV Facebook page, is the press showing its bias and out to get Donald Trump? Yes or no? And also, I forgot, Governor Jim Douglas. I want to thank him today as well. And I want to thank all of you for your phone calls. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great rest of your day.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.